City. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, what happens or could happen if you drink one of those popular energy drinks? Also, there's an extract that shows very positive anti-inflammatory and immune health benefits. Haven't heard about it before. I'll share it with you today. Two separate studies on resveratrol, the nutrient found in, well, in grapes primarily, but some other foods, and what it does to protect us. And if you know someone with an eating disorder, do they also suffer from perfectionism disorder? We'll talk about that. Brisk walking can help us specifically. I'll tell you about that. My guest in the second half of our program, and I'm going to allow more time for this, is because this is a very important topic for us. I'm going to be interviewing Professor Peter Kuznick. He is a professor of history at American University in Washington. And he's going to talk about looking at some of the more dark elements in American history during the last century that gave shape to the U.S. being perceived of as an empire, and what this means for America's future. But leading into that, I'll share some insights on what we should be doing today. The editors of Living Green magazine have looked at the work of Ellen LeConte. And Ellen is a contemporary writer and philosopher, has a very interesting perspective about life rules, nature's blueprint for surviving economic and environmental collapse, and what she says we should be doing. I'll share her insights. And then from David Lindorf from thiscan'tbehappening.net, growth is the enemy of humankind. This falls in line with a lot of progressives, myself included, who believe that we shouldn't be getting bigger at anything in corporate profits or expansion of our urban and suburban environments, exploiting more of nature, but instead we should be living a more austere life. In other words, what would happen if you didn't have all the toys we have today? So you had to spend more time on yourself and quality relationships. That will lead into our guest today. I don't know what else we'll have time for. I have a lot to share with you, including the newest information that will really dramatize the epidemic of homicide violence, the medications that all these people were on. And for those who want real specific proof, I will share it with you. I'll give you the names, the dates of at least 100 major killers. I'll give you where they killed and how many people they killed or wounded. But most importantly, they were all on drugs, from Prozac and Paxil and Zoloft, and how much of a coincidence it can be that 100 out of 100 mass killers all were on these meds and all engaged in school shootings. So for those who simply say the issue is gun control, I say pull back for a moment, please, and look at other mitigating pieces to this puzzle, and then make your mind up. Otherwise, we're not looking at the real underlying causes. Violence permeating in our society, and then overdiagnosing mental conditions that do not exist, and then medicating people in a way that the medication causes them to commit violent crimes. I don't know if we'll have time. If we do, I'll get into that. Let's begin. There's a simple way to have energy throughout the day. Start your day early. Between 4 a.m. and about 6 a.m., you're in a highly anabolic state. The body is preparing for the day ahead. You've gone through your catabolic state, the breaking down, the detoxification, cleansing, dead cells, accompanied by good bacteria and high levels of non-digestible or insoluble fibers sweep the mass of debris that your body no longer wants out through the colon and the rectum. This is the natural way it should be. This is all going on at night when you're sleeping. Your deepest sleep occurs between 11 p.m. and 4 a.m. That's also why if you stay up late, you're dead tired, you're nodding off, your eyes are closing, you're jerking your head back up to see where you're at, and you realize, gee whiz, I just nodded off for a half hour. But if you stay awake past 11, more often than not, let's say you stay up, go to a movie or something, come back, it's midnight, 1 o'clock, you're going to be wide awake, and you're thinking, wow, I can't go to sleep, I'm wide awake. It's because you have, in effect, overridden the natural circadian rhythms, the natural biological clocks that say it's time to sleep, it's time to get up. And in the first hour and a half of that deep sleep, that's where you're in your deepest rapid eye movement sleep, that's where the greatest healing, the most amount of melatonin is secreted by the brain that helps stimulate the immune system. Your immune system is stimulated, your pulse rate is down about 10%, your system slowed down by about 10%, your metabolism slows down, but you're cleansing. Then in the morning, you're awake. Now, if you start your day by first getting up and having a few things that will make a difference, like NADH, about 20 to 50 milligrams, coenzyme Q10, 100 to 500 milligrams, vitamin E from mixed natural tocopherols with tocotrienols, 400 to 800 units, magnesium, 400 to 800 milligrams, vitamin C, 500 to 1,000 milligrams, L-carnitine, 500 to 1,000 milligrams, and D-ribose, 1,000 to 2,000 milligrams, and glutamine, 1,000 to 3,000 milligrams, and very important for your muscle mass expansion, to get actual muscles, to get ripped, and to burn fat, conjugated linoleic acid, or CLA, 3 to 5,000 milligrams. And these are the most important. They're for bodybuilders or for extreme athletes, there are some other things you could certainly do to. But for this is helping your mitochondria. This is helping the production of what is called ATP, which stands for adenosine triphosphate, the actual combustion of energy inside the cell. So your cell now has energy to start a workout and sustain it. And then when you finish your workout, make sure you have a good quality antioxidant, generally vitamin C, alpha-lipoic acid, NAC, will help you post-exercise. Post-exercise, you've created a lot of free radicals. These antioxidants grab those free radicals, so you get the benefits of exercise and none of the downside. Creatine monohydrate at about 3 to 5,000 milligrams would also be great. Now, that's the ideal. Take it all down with some organic coconut water, giving you perfect magnesium or potassium levels, so you are good to go. All right? That's the ideal energy. Now, what we do instead is we stay up late. We're on the cell phones, not good for the chromosomes in your brain. And study after study of the resonating images show that the side of the head that you have the cell phone on is hot. Now, this isn't hocus pocus. This is just good science. This is just good MRI imaging, where you overheat the chromosomes, you're going to kill the chromosomes, creating free radicals in the chromosomes. You're going to adversely affect the telomeres. You're going to speed up the shortening of the telomeres, which speeds up the shortening of the lifespan of the cells. You're also going to alter them. And when you alter neurons, you end up causing Alzheimer's, dementia, cancer. I said 10 years ago that we'd start to see more cancers of the jaw, the head, and the brain. That is happening now. Over 20 studies, independent studies, not studies sponsored or paid for by the phone companies, the wireless companies, but independent shows abnormal reactions inside the body and mainly the brain when you're using cell phones. Then you're up on a computer. That throws off an electromagnetic pulse. That affects your overall energy level, can affect rhythms of the heart, can affect eyes and speed up oxidation stress in the eyes, which can speed up macular degeneration, cataracts, and glaucoma. And then when you're eating at night, bad for your blood sugar, bad for digestion, and generally eating things are unhealthy, which creates constipation, and therefore the toxins that should be removed by the body are not, creating an autotoxemic state, which means that a disproportionate amount of your immune system has to be around your intestines, your digestive tract, because they're so toxic. Then you wake up in the morning, you don't go out for that good exercise of 45 minutes to an hour, which you ideally should, because it strengthens the heart, lowers the pulse rate, which you want, lowers blood pressure to normal, which you want, helps stimulate a normal blood sugar, which you absolutely want, and speeds up cleansing, especially cleansing through the liver and the kidneys. So when you come back to take your shower and to have your breakfast, you should have really a nutrient-rich polyphenol breakfast, starting off with a quality vegetable-based protein. It could come from hemp, it could come from rice, or soy, or a split pea powder, any of these or any combination, and non-GMO, and about 20 to 30 grams, and then have your essential fatty acids from flaxseed oil. Throw in a hand of walnuts or almonds or pistachios raw, or coconut oil, that's good. Both those oils are terrific for you, different reasons, different. There are different lengths of the fatty acid chain. Some are antiviral, some are antibacterial. Both are immune-modulating in a good way. Then you make sure you have your berries, blueberries, raspberries, strawberries. Black currants are exceptional. Red currants are very good also. And pomegranates are great. The core of the pineapple, the pithiness, throw it in a blender, excellent. If you don't have the nuts, raw walnut butter. The nut butters are good, too. And then if you don't have all the fruit you want, then use your compounding powders, which give you the greatest single nutrient concentration you can have. They do the most good I know of in all of science for the body. And I've studied this for decades in anti-aging models, both in humans, over 47 clinical studies I've conducted with positive outcome, and in animal models, over 120 animal studies, all humane to the animal, actually helping animals live a longer life in a better environment, and even taking those that were in chemotherapy and radiation experiments that were done by orthodox scientists downstairs and taking them up and helping them regroup their life, in other words, helping them heal. So the advice I'm giving you is based upon good science. Science is catching up. So that's the way it should be done to start your day. Now, that kind of breakfast, and you should make it to last 3 days, as long as you put a simple scoop of vitamin C, let's say 1,000, 2,000 milligrams in there, that's what I do, then I make my breakfast 1 day a week, but I'm able to eat it 3 days a week. And then you can add additional concentrates depending upon what you want. You want some additional acai in there, fine, throw a tablespoon in, or goji powder, throw that in. But at least you have the basics for your protein, fat, carbohydrates, enzymes, phytonutrients, chlorophyll, fibers. You have everything the body needs to thrive and survive. What we're doing instead, however, is we're drinking an energy drink, not only when we wake up in the morning like a cola, but also during work. And you see them heavily advertised. Here's the latest on this. This is from Nutrition Business Journal. Quote, hospitalizations from energy drinks double. I'll quote this. Energy drink companies have taken yet another blow after over a year in the negative spotlight. On Friday, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration released a report citing energy drinks as, quote, continuing public health concern, end quote. The report showed that the number of annual hospital visits involving energy drinks, such as Monster, Red Bull, or 5-Hour Energy, doubled. And it's increased 1,000% since 2005. And it says the data, the most recent available, a government behavioral health agency, shows that an energy drink was a primary cause of contributing to 20,783 reported emergency room visits. Of this, 58% involved the energy drink alone, while the rest involved drugs as well. The majority of patients were male, 18 to 25, accounted for the largest. And why? Why? Well, it's simple. Read the labels. It's all that caffeine. When you're drinking that much caffeine, you're going to get headaches, heart attacks, insomnia, anxiety, and seizures. And they've also been linked to many deaths. So, in fact, 13 deaths alone just were attributed to 5-hour energy drink and Monster Energy. We're involved in 5 energy deaths from just those two. So I wrote one of my doctor dissertations on caffeine. Needless to say, the quack busters who support the sugar industry and the caffeine industry and the big pharma attacked it. But I did the clinical studies. I did the actual research to show the dangers of caffeine. So it's there. It's been posted on my website. People have read it. And there are a lot of damaging things that can happen from caffeine, including irregular heartbeat. And most importantly, for people with cancer, it promotes the growth of cancer. It's highly anabolic and pain. It can create what is known as local acidosis. So just be aware of that. So think twice before you use any of these energy drinks, unless they're natural energy drinks. You know, something simple like apple juice, grape juice, orange juice, grapefruit juice. Those are fine. Vegetable juice, berry juice. You're not going to have any caffeine. You're not going to have any emergency room visits. You're not going to die. It's something your body needs. But there's no money to be made in that, so we don't see it. From Africa, West Africa, you have what is called African sorghum. Now, sorghum is very common there. And now there's new science that shows that African sorghum is anti-inflammatory and immune health building. So that's good news for those who have arthritis and diabetes and fibromyalgia. That can help you. Also, there are at least 1,500 studies in the peer-reviewed literature showing the benefits of resveratrol. Resveratrol is concentrated in tablet form. It is different in every bottle of grape juice because it depends upon where the grapes were grown and how concentrated the juice is. But generally between 100 to 200 milligrams a day is what you want to get, because just some of the science shows that it lengthens the telomeres. Now, the most powerful nutrient I know of that can lengthen telomeres is carnosine. That's with a C, carnosine. 500 milligrams to 2,000 milligrams, what I would suggest. That's the single most important, powerful, all-inclusive anti-aging nutrient that exists anywhere. But resveratrol plays a role in there, because resveratrol also increases telomere length, which means it increases the life of the cell. But here's the newest from the peer-reviewed journal Food and Chemical Toxicology. This was done at Shandong University School of Medicine in China. Here's what it says. Resveratrol may help protect against alcohol-induced nerve damage. And that's big. And there's a lot of nerve damage due to alcohol use in the United States. So take your resveratrol. It can help. One other study that I came across, this one shows that it also helps with as a major antioxidant and helps reduce damage that can lead to heart disease. So make sure you do it. If you want to help men with prostate cancer, get them to walk power walk, like race walk. That's the latest study done at the University of California at San Francisco and Harvard School of Public Health. Brisk walking and a lowered risk of prostate cancer. They studied 1,400 men who had been diagnosed with early-stage prostate cancer, and they found that when participants walked at a rate of 3 miles per hour, which is slow, for at least 3 hours per week, they were 60% less likely to require second cancer treatment. My suggestion is this, that you walk 6 days a week for an hour, but much faster. Get the pace up, and so that you're walking so fast you can't talk. If you can walk and talk, you're walking too slow. And then you should be protected 100%. And finally, perfectionism and eating disorders. It's a complex issue. But this is from Biomed Central. And it says, and this was published in the Journal of Eating Disorders. And because I've counseled many people with eating disorders, and in one in particular who quite simply would have been dead, she was just bones. I mean, it's scary to think how skinny a person could be. You see the pictures of the survivors of concentration camps, and they're just, you wonder how they even survived. Well, I've counseled people that skinny, and yet in their mind, they still think that they're fat. And the idea is that it's not an eating disorder, it's a perception disorder. So I approach all these as perception disorders. Change the perception, you change the reality. Just talk about foods, you don't. You know, measuring foods and having a roommate in a clinic so that one person makes sure the other one doesn't eat and then purge. That's really not the solution. Anyhow, in this study, here's what they said, and I'll quote it. Two aspects of perfectionism are involved in body dissatisfaction and the development of eating disorders. According to over 1,000 women published in the Biomed Central's Open Access Journal of Eating Disorders, adaptive perfectionism is high standards driving a person towards achieving a goal body image, and maladaptive perfectionism is concerned with mistakes and other people's opinions. The findings indicate that both are involved in heightened concerns about body image, which in turn places people at risk of developing an eating disorder. So, we know that perfectionism is recognized as an important factor in eating disorders. The exact role of perfectionism is perceived body image. And so the idea, from my perspective, is to work with a person on changing perceptions. When you change a perception, it automatically changes the reality. But at least now they're pinning it down. And by the way, if your child has been diagnosed with ADHD, they're not alone. According to Kaiser Permanente, quote, study found disproportionately high ADHD diagnosis rates among white children and dramatic increases in black girls. And this was published in the JAMA's Pediatrics, formerly the Archives of Pediatrics. And it's an enormous increase, just enormous. Why? It's simple. Because the moment your child fidgets in school, doesn't pay attention, is restless, doesn't seem to have the same ability to do a test as others, it's so easy for the teacher to say, go see the school psychologist. You probably have ADHD. Keep in mind that today our children are considered pathologies. Once the diagnosis is given, then the drugs are given, and then the child is forever on the drugs. But let's just say that you have a child that goes to school and looks out the window. They're not particularly interested in what's being said. Maybe that they're distracted or tired. Maybe they were up late. Maybe they don't have enough natural blood sugar levels. No one's measuring blood sugar levels in schools across the country. If you don't have a good breakfast, then how are you supposed to maintain your energy throughout a day? You can't, especially if you've gone all night. Let's say your last meal you ate was at 7 o'clock the night before, and it's now 7 o'clock the next morning. It's 12 hours. And then you're in a highly anabolic state. You're burning energy. Your blood sugar level could come down. You could suffer from hypoglycemia. And now you can't focus. You can't remember. And you're fidgety. Just like a kid that hasn't eaten or needs a nap. They're fidgety. Diagnosing him with a mental condition doesn't help anyone. So, and also schools frequently get extra money the more that kids are diagnosed. I've seen so many parents who've come to me. I even did a whole health support group on this. Children who were diagnosed with ADD and ADHD, putting them on a healthy schedule and discipline to make sure they went to bed at night, and then detoxifying them and reestablishing a healthy eating program and letting them understand the consequences of not being focused, we were able to show over a 90% reversal of their so-called ADHD and ADD. That meant that they had all been diagnosed wrong, treated wrong. So instead of looking for the real causes, they're simply disguising it. One last thing. I found this particularly interesting. This is from the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine. Your mainstream doctors and nurses will not offer you alternative therapy, but they seek it for themselves. Let's say you go to a doctor and you're tired, or you lack motivation, or you suffer from a general malaise, or insomnia. The likely outcome, you're going to get an antidepressant. But that same doctor, having the same symptoms that they gave you the antidepressant, will frequently seek out a non-toxic, natural, and alternative therapy. In fact, 76% of healthcare workers use complementary and alternative medicine. That's even more than the general population of 63%. Now, what are they using? This is what's interesting. They're using acupuncture, Ayurvedic, biofeedback, chelation, chiropractic, deep breathing, improved enhanced diet, Reiki energy work, imagery and meditation, homeopathy, hypnosis, massage. Yeah, they're getting all the good stuff. They're just not advising that you get it. A little bit of hypocrisy there? I think so. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome, all of you. I'm Gary Noll. We're going to go to our guest in about 5 minutes, but I wanted to share some insights from Ellen LeConte from her work called Life Rules, Nature's Blueprint for Surviving Economic and Environmental Collapse. Here's what she says. Quote, the prevailing attitude seems to be that globalization is good, or will be as soon as the bugs get worked out. What most people can't seem to grasp, or perhaps more accurately don't want to believe, is that globalization isn't the exact opposite of what we should be doing. It's the exact opposite, I should say. It's a system that's doomed, and for a simple reason. It goes against the laws of life itself. Life evolved locally and regionally, and in economies that couldn't burn and churn through the Earth's finite supplies of resources. It put global economies that could out of business. Simply put, the global economy is too big not to fail. Now, what's this mean? It means economies of every kind and size are dependent upon the largest economy, the largest supplier of goods and services, which they are a part of. For us, contrary to what you have been assumed, the largest economy is not the global monetary economy. It's the biosphere, life itself. You see, life manages Earth's account sustainability, which is how it has managed to last for 4 billion years. The global economy does not manage Earth's accounts sustainably. Under its influence, we are living beyond the Earth's means. LeConte explains that if we continue to degrade and spend down Earth's trust accounts of good soils, fresh water, oceanic carbon sinks, for example, it doesn't matter how much money is floating around in the econosphere or who has it. We can't restore depleted resources and degraded natural systems overnight the way the Federal Reserve can print more money or raise a debt ceiling. That's why LeConte's bottom line is this: life rules, we don't. Once our global economy has exhausted the natural resources and the ecosystem services that are true and commonwealth, it can't get any bigger. We're almost to that point right now. We're tipping, and the leaders and the systems that have caused and perpetuated this crisis can't and won't solve it for us. Like Einstein said, you can't solve a problem with the same kind of consciousness that in the same worldview that created it. The blind can't lead the blind out of this mess. Life teaches us how long-lasting, sustainable economies work. These economies are local, not global. Think about it this way. The Earth doesn't have one ecosystem or climate, but many, as different from each other as oranges are from apples. Diversity is the way life guaranteed some living things and systems would have the skills to survive almost any cataclysm. This means that we can diversify. We can relocalize, or in more realistic terms, to regionalize economically, fit ourselves into these smart living systems and work with them. To do that, we need to figure out what natural and human resources will still work in the way that we need them to. Now, we have to also be honest, and we have to look at the end of cheap easy. What is cheap easy? Well, for LeConte, it's oil and other fossil fuels. We're quickly depleting the worldwide supply of oil, and there are no new cheap easy fields. We don't want to admit it, but abundant, inexpensive oil is history. What difference does that make to you? You're saying, Gary, I don't really care. I go out to my car, I've got gasoline there. I turn on my heater and the oil, you know, oil-filled pump goes in. So why do I care? Well, for one thing, there's no replacement that can do all that oil has done as cheaply and universally as oil has done it. Now, mind you, I support solar. Most importantly, I support what is the ultimate cheap and constant energy source, which is wave power. We have that. We have it in the East River in New York City. Just remember, when you talk about replacing oil with solar, with wind, where it's aesthetically feasible and not a noise pollution and an air pollution, but off the ocean, off the coast, and up in the high mountains in Arizona, and geothermal that we haven't even begun to touch in the United States, that's all good, and we should do that. But that's not going to be as cheap as oil. Nearly all the goods and services the global economy provides in one way or another are oil-dependent. When oil's too expensive or gone, so are all these things that we had. Plus, energy analysts predict that it can add to the end of cheap, easy oil the imminent end to cheap, easy coal and natural gas. And if there's no cheap, easy fossil fuels, then there won't be a worldwide global economy. So just remember this. One more reason to start thinking of a more austere way of living. That doesn't mean down and dirty. It just means more conscious. Do we need all these things? We don't. The things we own should not replace the quality of our lives, the meaning of our lives. We are more important than the work we do and the things we own. Also think of good weather. Only dyed-in-the-wool deniers still believe that climate isn't changing. The world is becoming warmer overall, but the weather is also more unpredictable and violent. So cheap, easy weather is on the way out. The familiar species and ecosystems with which humans have cohabited from time immemorial are gone if the familiar congenial climate is no more. Already weather-related emergencies and disasters and crops and business losses and species and human migrations alone have made the world's weather costly to lives. Plus, these events have served to further destabilize the economy. Is it not true that the latest Hurricane Sandy cost New York and New Jersey about $60 to $70 billion? And that's the cheap storm. What happens next year when the weather continues to get worse and we have a Category 2, 3, 4, or 5? Any major city that hits at a Category 3 to 5 will double that cost. Then water. We're not even discussing water. But frightening worldwide demand for water will exceed supply by 50% in just the next 9 years. Water-intensive globalized agribusiness and livestock operations, global industrialization and pollution, and growing populations and wasteful distribution processes have contributed to the shortfall in fresh water supplies around the world. With rising prices and rationale, we'll soon be saying so long to cheap, easy water. And then food. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that the end of cheap, easy oil, water, and weather signals the end of cheap, easy food. Arable land is already at a premium everywhere in the world, and what they're not looking at is what happens when we deplete it even further because of fossil-fueled farming techniques. Of the world's 7 billion people, according to LeConte, a third are well-fed, at least for now. Okay, but there's a third underfed, and there's a third that's 2 billion people that hover between malnutrition and total starvation. And therefore, it's going to grow. And finally, prosperity. Unless you've been living under a rock, you know what a roller coaster ride the global economy has taken most Americans on. You've probably felt the recession's effects on yourself. According to LeConte, no matter what they promise, politicians can't conjure prosperity out of thin air. And in an economy facing this many pending scarcities, the goods and services on which it makes its money will be adversely affected. Credit, cash, capital. The keys to conventional definitions of prosperity will, like the other items that I just mentioned, cease to be either cheap or easy to get. So the thoughts of bringing economies closer to home flourish whenever a prevailing economy fails to deliver the goods people expect from it, or when it seems to deliver more harm than good. And unless you're among the top 10% of Americans, you're already experiencing some of that harm now. So I thank the people at over at Reliance.org and Countercurrents.org and the people, the editors of Living Green Magazine, for letting us know that the Earth is not a global village, even though Hillary Clinton and the corporate Democrats would like us to believe that. And globalization, neo-colonial rule, imperative overdrive, all the treaties, GATT, NAFTA, the current worst treaty in American history, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, these are based upon unlimited sustaining growth. It's simply not possible. It's time that we had some realists in positions of power. And finally, before we go to my guest, who is standing by, shouldn't we examine growth, endless growth, as the real enemy of humankind? David Lindorf believes so. I believe so. I've discussed this many times. So the question is, what is wrong with America? It's a big question. It is a simple answer. I believe that we confuse the complexity of problems with the simplicity of how we should perceive a solution. We Americans are completely lost in any sense of why our country, our society, and our government exist. Politicians, lobbyists, and corporate media talking heads, and far too many ordinary people have accepted and are promoting a gospel, the circular notion that it's important to encourage business to grow so that people will be hired and the economy will grow because of that. This specious argument is used to justify the weakening of labor unions, the raising of taxes on workers while they are cut for companies and the rich, the gutting of social systems that help the poor and the middle class and the working class, but giving enormous social incentive to the mega corporations, the military-industrial complex, big agri, big pharma, big banking. big insurance, and yet they want to cut earned benefit programs like Social Security, Medicare. The gutting of worker safety and environmental regulations, and the elimination of regulations of activities like banking, corporate mergers and takeovers, and pharmaceutical companies, etc. In fact, every government action that results in making life harder or more dangerous for ordinary working people or for the poor is defended on the basis that it is necessary so that business can make more profit and help the economy grow. Growing the economy, however, is not, as certainly should not, be the reason we have government, the reason we are a country, or the reason we are a society. The Declaration of Independence had it right when in its inspiring preamble it aroused a nation of rebels by espousing the inalienable right of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, period. And growth today poses a direct threat to all three of those stated goals. In summation, growth in all of its aspects, economic growth, growth in profits, growth in sales, growth in population, growth in income, is a threat to the life we live today. It has become clear that the imperative of ever more growth, the ethos and driving force of modern corporate capitalism, is leading to the destruction of the very biosphere that sustains life on this planet. It is a threat to the liberty, too. Because one country's growth, America's, requires the constant assault on those weaker countries that threaten us. The globe is a finite place. And at this point, with 7 billion people crowded upon it, for one group, that is to say 313 million Americans, to prosper and grow requires that 6.7 billion others give up something. In other words, for America to grow, it must be in a constant state of imperial domination and war, which also means a state of war at home with all the commitment that that requires, the restrictions of our freedom, not to mention the challenging of the public, taking 53 cents out of every tax dollar for the war machine. For decades or longer even, there has been a carefully maintained American myth that the growth of global capitalism in general and of this country's capitalist system in particular has been only beneficial to mankind, really with no downside, and it's a myth. But this myth has been a lie. Capitalism in Europe grew at the expense of colonies in Africa, Asia, and Latin America that were exploited for their virtually free stolen resources and their cheap labor, as well as their captive markets. And the U.S. expansion into and theft of the Indian territories and their resources, as well as the free labor of the vast slave population until 1865, and continued exploitation of black and Latino workers since then, allowed for dramatic economic growth, a small portion of which was shared with white workers for a time when that growth in the restive stage occurred up through the middle of the 20th century. But because it is no longer possible for American capitalism to grow simply by exploiting other nations while buying the passivity and acquiescence of the American masses at home by minimally allowing them to have some small part of the gains, economic growth now inevitably requires the impoverishment and progressive disempowerment of most Americans, and vastly more powerful corporate interests, having implanted the ideology of growth is good, are now demanding that we accept lower wages, less freedom and empowerment on the job, less safety, more environmental degradation, less health care, less equality in education, and quality of education, less security in our old age. Our ability to pursue happiness, in other words, has also fallen victim to the unbridled pursuit of growth. This is, of course, absurd. For tens of thousands of years, human beings lived, built families, laughed, loved, created music and dance and art and found happiness in their lives. They did this with no growth, or at least with growth so slow that no one would have noticed it happening. It is only in the past, perhaps, few hundred years that growth has become an all-encompassing obsession of the rich and powerful, to be had at any cost, and happiness, liberty, and the end life are all being lost in that mad pursuit of ever more profit and wealth. In many countries, these three values simply don't exist. In the U.S., we still have life, a little liberty, and some shot at happiness. But it is all under grave threat. Now to my guest, Dr. Peter Kuznick, professor of history at American University in Washington, where he has also served as director of the university's Nuclear Studies Institute. He has specialized in American political history, the history of nuclear science, and the Cold War. And he is also the co-author with Academy Award-winning film director Oliver Stone of the New York Times bestseller, The Untold History of the United States, which is the basis for the television series with the same title on Showtime. In the revisionist tradition of Howard Zinn and Morris Berman and others, Peter and Oliver's research focuses the darker elements that shaped the U.S. during the past century into the present moment, whereby today the U.S. is commonly regarded as an imperial or imperialist ambition position around the world. Nice to have you with us, sir.
Nice to be here, Gary.
Before we get into some of the more important personalities, historical events, and political decisions in American history that has led to the U.S. emerging as a global empire, and for the moment I want to assume that the U.S. is very much an empire, I would like to ask you two issues. Why so many Americans, and especially our elected officials and politicians, believe that this is a good thing? Even Obama sees the U.S. in terms of being a savior of the world. From my position and from what I observe when I look across the American landscape, we are unable to save our citizens from destitution, homelessness, from foreclosures, from poverty and hunger, and from being victimized from corporate profiteering. So why does America believe that an imperial U.S. is an ideal to cherish? And then second, what does it say about the way American history is taught in schools that strengthens its imperialist ambition, and also by whitewashing our darker side and the delusional policies made by our leaders and exemplified by Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck, who don't want us to see anything but an exceptional state of mind? The forum is yours. Take your time.
Well, this idea goes back to the early founding of the country. John Winthrop aboard the Arbella in his 1630 sermon talked about the United States as being a city upon a hill. So we've always had that benighted sense that we can set an example for the rest of mankind. And that view has persisted through the decades and through the centuries. It was Woodrow Wilson after Versailles when he said that now the world will understand that the United States is the savior of the world. But that theme runs throughout our history up to the present. It was Madeleine Albright in 1998 who said, if we use force, it's because we're the United States. We're the indispensable nation. We stand taller and see farther than other countries. Obama also recently referred to the United States as the indispensable nation. So this is part of the air we breathe already. We don't even question that. This notion of American exceptionalism, the idea that the United States is different from other countries, that other countries are motivated by greed or by desire for land or resources, self-aggrandizement, that the United States alone among countries acts in the interests of mankind, that the United States is motivated by generosity, altruism, benevolence, kindness, that we only fight to spread freedom and democracy. This is a view that most Americans don't even question. And it's very insidious. It's very dangerous. It undergirds all of our expansionist attitudes, and it allows us to believe that we have the right to dictate to other countries because we're doing it in their self-interest, not in our own. So it becomes a very dangerous view of history that allows us to march off into all of these wars, and the consequences of these wars are often devastating, not only for the Americans, but for other countries. Our educational system, however, reinforces that. It goes unquestioned largely in the public schools and goes unquestioned through much of the media, and it's consciously perpetuated by the O'Reillys and the Limbaughs of the world. So the reason why Oliver and I decided to do this project was because we want to puncture that myth. We want to challenge it. We want Americans to see their history in a broader sense and understand some of the good that's been done, but also all of these dangerous actions that we've taken on. We've become, as you were suggesting, the global hegemon. We've got somewhere between 700 and 1,000 military bases around the world. Our drone policy is very, very dangerous right now, where we're assuming that, you know, during the Bush administration, we were all appalled that Bush would have the temerity to actually do surveillance and to eavesdrop on people without judicial review. Well, Obama has been killing people without judicial review, and where is the outcry against that? We look at the various manifestations of U.S. imperial overreach, and we need to be much more critical. Obama was credited with a very liberal inaugural address the other day, but he hardly touched on foreign policy at all. He rarely mentions empire. Empire has become something that was being widely discussed a few years ago. The New York Times Sunday Magazine for January 5th, 2003, the cover story was headlined, American Empire, Get Used to It. And that was something that was widely accepted. The neocons were bragging about it. You don't hear them talking about empire anymore because of what's happened over the past decade, where even they have been forced to realize that this has been a disaster for the United States and a worse disaster for the rest of the world. Even Robert Gates said that any president who commits American troops in a land war like this again should have his head examined. Well, we know that for a long time. MacArthur told that to Kennedy, and keep on making the same mistake over and over again. So Oliver and I decided to do this project in an effort to teach Americans about their history so we don't keep on making these same mistakes.
I appreciate that insight. I'm concerned that the average American today, even college students, are not familiar with the people who were the progenitors of the policies we're now examining. For example, Truman. In my opinion, Truman was an absolutely despicable president, a real tyrant of the 20th century. That's my own personal opinion. After all, he dropped the bomb. He increased military base around the world. The call for fighting all communism and remilitarization of Germany following its division and further testing of big bombs that threatened the Soviets and his, and then you look at someone such as Henry Wallace. He was the quintessential progressive who opposed U.S. colonist ambitions. He was anti-nuclear, opposed the Truman Doctrine, which set the stage for American intervention in any country where it could have been taken over by the Soviet Union. But this led to our support of wretched, undemocratic governments and dictators around the world, including the current ones that we had supported, like Mubarak and tyrants. He opposed the Cold War stance, and so Truman had him thrown out. So could you give us a view of some of the people who were really responsible as major policymakers for how we have gotten in the mess we're in, and some of the people who may be unknown heroes who tried to set it right?
Well, let's start with the two who you just mentioned. Harry Truman, who left office with approval ratings so low that they have only been challenged since then by George W. Bush. And even Bush didn't get as low as Truman did. Truman has now been anointed a near-great president. In fact, Condoleezza Rice, when she was asked by Time magazine for her man of the century in 1999, said Harry Truman was her man of the century. Democrats embrace him. Republicans embrace him. He is extolled as a man of wisdom and virtue. I wouldn't go so far as you in vilifying Truman. I think he's just a little man who is in way over his head. In fact, when he was tapped by Boss Pendergast in 1934 to run for Senate as the candidate of the Pendergast machine in Missouri, the leading Chicago newspaper asked them, why did you choose Harry Truman, of all people, to run for the Senate? And Pendergast said, I wanted to show the world that a well-oiled machine could take a petty clerk and get him elected to the Senate. And the same thing happens with Truman when he becomes president. He'd been vice president for 82 days before that. He's spoken to Roosevelt twice. He was held in such low regard by the people in that administration that nobody even bothered to tell Truman that we were building an atomic bomb. Truman doesn't even find this out until after he's been sworn in as president, after Roosevelt died on April 12, 1945. So we're talking about a little man who was in way over his head in a difficult position where he was going to have to make some of the most important decisions in all history. And he made most of the wrong ones. It was not that he was, he wasn't an evil person. He wasn't a Hitler by any means, but he made terribly wrong decisions on things. The counterposition to Truman was Henry Wallace, a man who has been almost entirely lost to history. And one of our goals in this project has been to resuscitate Wallace's reputation. When I ask my students who was vice president for Roosevelt from 1941 to 1945, almost none of them know the answer. He's really been whitewashed. He's been purged from the historical record, and we're trying to change that. Roosevelt chose him because he knew we were on the verge of a war against fascism and militarism, and he wanted a real progressive. And Wallace, who had been his Secretary of Agriculture from 33 to 40, was the man he chose because he knew that Wallace was a leading, outspoken, anti-fascist, anti-racist progressive. In 1941, Henry Luce writes his famous editorial and speeches saying the 20th century must be the American century. The United States will dominate the world in all ways. Wallace countered that and said that, no, the 20th century must become the century of the common man. And he called for a worldwide people's revolution to end imperialism, colonialism, economic exploitation, to spread the fruits of science and education around the world. And he had enemies. The Wall Street people hated him. The British and French colonialists hated him. The Southern segregationists hated him. The anti-feminists hated him. And the party bosses decided they were going to get him off the ticket in 1944 because they knew that Roosevelt would not likely last another term. And they chose Truman to replace him. But it wasn't that easy because at the convention, July 20th, 1944, that steamy night in Chicago when the Democratic convention opened, Gallup did a poll of potential voters asking who they wanted on the ticket as vice president. 65% of potential voters said they wanted Wallace as vice president. 2% said they wanted Harry Truman. So the party bosses were in a very difficult position to fix the convention. And that night, Wallace made the seconding speech for Roosevelt. The place went wild. In the midst of this 45-minute spontaneous demonstration, Senator Claude Pepper from Florida knew that if he could get to the microphone and get Wallace's name and nomination, Wallace would sweep the convention, get back on the ticket, and be the vice president again. Then he would have become president in April 45 instead of Truman. Well, Pepper fought his way to the microphone, got literally 5 feet from the microphone before the bosses forced the convention to adjourn. Had he gotten 5 more feet to the microphone, Oliver and I are arguing, there would have certainly been no atomic bombing in 1945, which Wallace was strongly opposed to, and it would very likely have been no Cold War at all. There are a number of points like this of our history that Americans simply don't know about. And once they did, they would see that there are other possible courses for history, that our present morass is not the only alternative, and that even now it's possible to change the direction of history, which is what we're trying to do.
One last question, please. I like the I.F. Stone quote you and Oliver Stone provide in a record, a recent op-ed piece. You say, quote, I.F. Stone, "All governments lie, but disaster lies in wait for countries whose officials smoke the same hashish they give out," end quote. So why is war so attractive for both American domestic and foreign policy that we were so willing to lie ourselves into going to war, with Woodrow Wilson lying us into our First World War, Truman and the Cold War about the global red threat, which was a lie, the Gulf of Tonkin,
exactly,
getting us into Vietnam, and then, of course, the Bush administration's lies to deepen us further in the Middle East after
9/11. And the first Bush administration's lies about Kuwait. We've got this pattern of... And when you have people who stand up against that, the way John F. Kennedy did after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and stood up and defied the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the military-industrial complex, I mean, that's the kind of courage we need, which is exactly the first person to give us a blurb for our book was Mikhail Gorbachev. And Gorbachev has said that Obama has got to find the kind of backbone to take some risks, to stand up against these people. He's showing some glimmers of hope that he might be starting to get this a little bit. But he's got to show that kind of courage and backbone, and the American people will rally behind that. I'm convinced that the American people are sick and tired of warfare, of spending 40% of our budget on military, intelligence, defense-related ideas, and that we're ready for rebuilding infrastructure, we're ready for improving education, we're ready for feeding hungry people here at home. And so that's the message that people need to know. But they also need to know that there have been strong Americans, even leaders, but certainly masses, who have fought against this kind of imperial policy throughout our history. And we also highlight that.
Well, you've done a magnificent job, you and Oliver Stone, and hopefully people will read the book, The Untold History of the United States, and watch the 10-part series on Showtime. Go to SHO.com. Thank you very much for being on with us today.
Thanks, Gary. It's my pleasure.
My guest, Professor Peter Kuznick, KUZNICK. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. I thank you all for this little extended edition. Let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we're going to be talking about the hearings on Benghazi in Congress today.
Great. We look forward to it.
Thanks.
Utrice Lead, coming at you right now on the Progressive Radio Network. Please stay tuned.
Heavenly shades of night are falling. It's twilight time. Out of the mist your voice is calling. Tis twilight time. When purple colored curtains mark the end of day, I'll hear you, my dear, at twilight time. Deepening shadows gather splendor as day is done. Fingers of night.